Even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoo's cry, I long for Kyoto. I'll give you that again. Even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoo's cry, I long for Kyoto. So that's a famous haiku by Basho. And the haiku is a very, as you know, a Japanese form. I've never been convinced that the haiku works in English. It's a very short form, and in English it often doesn't come off. Many English poets, many American poets particularly, think it doesn't really work. But recently I was talking to Robert Hass, who translated that haiku. He was here on a poetry and meditation retreat, American poet. And he was just explaining to us all the background, the context of that. So even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoo's cry, I yearn, I long for Kyoto. So the word cuckoo in Japanese, it sounds kyokyo. That is how it sounds. So partly what he's doing, he's playing on the word for cuckoo, which is very, very similar to the word for Kyoto. Yeah? Also, at that time, cuckoos, in a haiku form, you're always supposed to mention a season. So a Japanese reader would immediately know when they read cuckoo that you meant it was a summer bird. So it's a summer haiku, yeah? So you immediately took in the matter of the season. So you've got this two things already. And then at that time, cuckoos were thought to vomit blood at the end of singing 8,008 times and then die. That was the tradition, yeah? So they'd sing 8,008 times and then they'd die, yeah? So when you get the tiny bit of the context, a little bit of the world in which Basho was talking about, you realise how little you understand it. You think you understand it, but you don't really. It's actually very difficult to know whether you understand it or not. It feels like you do, but you really don't, or at least you don't know. So Basho lived 100 years after Milarepa. So my contention is we can't really understand his words, which is fine, except we easily think we can. Perhaps we can, we just don't really quite know. We don't know the cultural context, we don't know the historical context, we don't know the Mahamudra context. Some of us have read about Mahamudra, but none of us have grown up in it, lived and breathed it. We don't really know. So I don't feel qualified to talk about Milarepa's vision. In fact, I think it's better to stick to our own context, to our own shared vision of spiritual life. I can't really say much about Milarepa's because, even looking at that translation of a haiku by Basho, which is only a few syllables long, there's so much of it I didn't get when I heard it. So how much of Milarepa are we just not getting that we don't resonate with? Yeah? So I'd rather stay with our own context, our own shared understanding of the goal, what the goal consists in, our own shared milestones along the way, such as becoming a mitra, being ordained, and so on, our own shared symbolic vocabulary, which we're still developing, and probably most importantly, or as important, very importantly, our own shared language. I think we need to sort of understand those things much more deeply, rather than sort of riff off too much on Milarepa. Now, because all these things are shared, doesn't mean to say they're not changing. We're not interested in a Buddhist heritage site. We're not interested in a sort of Bantu heritage site. But nor are we trying to create a sort of pick-and-mix Buddhism, a pick-and-mix modern Buddhism that takes a bit from somebody from over there and a bit from somebody from over there. So, just because it's shared doesn't mean it's not changing. But I think this question of a sort of shared vision is much more difficult than we think. And I've got three little ideas about why I think it's more difficult than we think. I think it's difficult to have this shared vision, partly because Bhante's elucidation of the Dharma is deceptively clear and straightforward. I think actually that's the reason why it's difficult to have a shared vision. It's deceptively clear and straightforward, as if you don't really need to think about it. When you read Bhante, remember reading him when you first read him, you just think, yes, that's true, that's fair enough. It doesn't look on the face of it, because his writing, I think, is so good, and his thinking is so clear, it doesn't really look like you need to think much about it. At the moment, I'm trying to write a book on the five great stages from the papers. And I set off to write about integration. As soon as you start writing about integration, what on earth does he mean by it? When you try and write about it, it's all right to just chat about it, but when you try and write about it and clarify what it means and how it differs from a psychological idea of integration, for instance, you suddenly realise you don't really know what he means by it. You've taught it and so on, but you don't really know what he means by it. So I think his deceptively clear and straightforward writing of the Dharma actually makes it more difficult for us to share it, because we don't think we need to think about it and think we could even get away with not thinking about it. The second reason I think it's difficult to share this is because, I am hammering through this because I haven't got much time. So there isn't any jokes, I'm afraid. Sometimes people expect me to do jokes, and sometimes I'm just frankly not in the mood. You're like that too? I'm like that. So the second reason why I think it's difficult to share Bhante's elucidation of the Dharma is that what we're really trying to share is what Bhante himself calls that indefinable spirit. That indefinable spirit that through him has founded the movement and order. Really, that's what we're trying to share, an indefinable spirit. Bhante, at the end of that paper, is saying, actually, we need to really take care of that, and we shouldn't try and pin it down. If you try and pin it down too much, you lose it. So we're actually trying to share an indefinable spirit. In my own imagination, that means it's as if we all need to be in our mind basically looking at the same thing, which we can never quite describe, but we all need to be looking at it in our mind and have the same path towards it. And that path and that thing that we're looking at, that ideal that we're looking at, needs to be manifest in a million details of ordinary life. And it's difficult to see whether we are sharing this indefinable spirit. The most important thing, sharing this indefinable spirit, is the most difficult to see whether we are sharing it. I've met order members who look like they're sharing it and even use the language of it, but I'm afraid one sometimes doubts. Yeah? I've also met order members who don't look like they're sharing it and don't sometimes even use the language, but when you explore with them more deeply, they're sharing it very deeply indeed. You feel it. And I think when you know you're sharing, it's to do with a felt sense. It's not primarily an intellectual sense, although it includes that. It's a felt sense. So you can look like you're sharing it and not be, and not look like you're sharing it and be sharing it. Thirdly, it's difficult to be clear about Bhante's elucidation of the Dharma because there are so many competing views, even apparently Buddhist views, from Daniel Ingram's to Al Yu, but then you riff off that to things like modern Vedanta. I've been struck by how many people come along to us through AA and the views of AA. I'm even noticing a huge surge of contact improvisation, which I'm sure has its own views. That's dancing, folks. Trying to have a clear vision of Buddhism and how it coincides and departs from those views is very, very difficult. And I don't think it's something I'm up to. You know, I read something from another tradition, I think, yeah, sounds fair enough. It takes a better mind than me very often to see, no, but to see how it departs from the Dharma there. Yes, that part is accurate, but that part departs from the Dharma. To have that kind of deep understanding of the Dharma, I think, is very rare. I'm afraid, have it myself. I think it's not I'm not able to think at that depth. So my instinct today is, and this for this short period of time, is just to try and keep it simple. So what I've been thinking myself is that the great question of spiritual life is how does dukkha become shraddha? Really, that's what my life boils down to, especially as I'm getting older. I think that is the great issue, is how does dukkha become shraddha? Even when we think that, we need to remember that dukkha may or may not be felt. Sorry, dukkha always is felt. A shraddha may or may not be felt. Shraddha can be, like any emotion, can be sentimentalised. So it may or may not be felt. It's probably more like what motivates you to act in ways that orientate you or orientate me to the Buddha Dharma, such as being here today, coming on this convention. Shraddha is what makes you do things that help you enter the stream of the Dharma. Sometimes you feel that as inspiration, sometimes you actually actively don't feel it. you actively don't want to come to the convention, but something brings you here. Yeah. So if we can live primarily motivated by Shraddha rather than by greed or hatred, delusion or existential apathy, the rest is assured, really. Our lives will feel thoroughly worthwhile, it seems to me. And that's what I want, is a thoroughly worthwhile life. So of course this means actually being with dukkha. It means experiencing dukkha, feeling dukkha. That sense of unfulfillment, of dissatisfaction, of life not coming up to much, or not coming up to what you'd hoped it would come up to. Ashantideva's, everywhere I go, there is no enjoyment for me anywhere. I'm sure he doesn't mean that literally, but I think it's a huge statement about one's direct experience of life, that you just can't get it to work, that life just doesn't work. Yeah? That's, I think, is what dukkha is that life doesn't work. And of course there's a sort of koan in this, even in this matter of feeling dukkha, because to really feel dukkha, to really face up to dukkha, to die into it, we need a degree of Shraddha. Otherwise, we just can't help but hold on. If we don't have a degree of Shraddha, if we don't have a degree of a sense that there is more to life than ordinary waking consciousness and matter and the body and so forth, if we don't have some sense that there's more to life than that, we won't be able to let go of ourselves. We won't be able to go beyond ourselves because, well, we just won't be able to stop holding on because we won't be able to let go into something. We'll feel we'll get annihilated or we'll fall into despair. As I've been getting older, my health has been getting gradually worse. And so I have quite a lot of ongoing discomfort. I'm sure many of you do. And as we get older, we'll all have more. Yeah. And very, very difficult not to fall into despair with it. It's sort of all right when you're young. You sort of think, oh, well, we'll cobble it through. But as you get older, there's been more of that literal dukkha. So it's very easy to fall into despair. So I think often we're just not in a healthy enough mental state to really stay with dukkha. We don't have the courage, we don't have the confidence, we don't have the faith to face up to our disappointments, to our unfulfillment, to our unfulfilled longing, that sense of wishing we'd had more, wishing we were more successful, wishing whatever it is, that sense of, yes, unfulfillment, that arises in amongst us as much as it does out there, doesn't it? It's very, very easy to compare oneself with others and think, oh, I'm not as good as them, I haven't done as much as them, and so on. I'm not as spiritual as them. So quite a lot of our practice is getting enough faith, enough right view and enough positive emotion to really face the fact that life doesn't work. I think that's what spiritual death is about, is getting to the point where you can really face the fact that life doesn't work. So I think there's three ways of avoiding this. Three ways, at least. It's always handy to come with threes because they're slightly memorable, hopefully. Three ways in which I think it's easy to avoid dukkha. Probably we could think of our life very much in terms of how we avoid dukkha. So the first one I came up with, off the top of my head, as it were, was over-personalising it. That the first way we can avoid dukkha is to over-personalise it. This is when we get caught up in our own personal trauma and pain, our own history, our own pain. Before I got ordained, particularly, I did a lot of this, as Karma Bhante knows. I used to go on and on about my own personal trauma and pain to the boredom of those around me. So that's one thing we can do, just get caught up in our own history of pain. But the dukkha that we're trying to face is universal. I think one of the dangers of spiritual life is we keep thinking of it to do with me rather than to do with us. Even writing about spiritual life, very difficult to keep talking about us rather than me. So recently, as I said, I was leading a poetry and meditation retreat here. I keep on indicating this because this is where we're sitting interviewing the poets. And David Constantine, who's well known as a German scholar and a translation of Brecht, but a poet in his own right. Very interesting man, a very committed socialist in the old-fashioned sense of this isn't good enough, this world isn't good enough, and yes, we should change it, and it can be changed. You just need to get off your Nautimus Maximus, you're behind, and go and do something. I was very, very impressed with him. I've met him before. I'm very, very impressed with him. And he wrote me a long letter after the retreat in which he was concerned about the Buddha figures. He went to look at the Buddha figure in the field just there. He went to look at the Buddha figure in the shrine room. And he was really concerned about their smile. He said, "What are they smiling at?" these Buddha figures. He said, "What I'm very aware of at the moment is the bombing of children in Gaza. That's what's foremost in my mind. So I walked to your very nice retreat center." He says it much nicer than it. He's a lovely, lovely man. I see these very peaceful Buddhas smiling to themselves. What are they smiling about? What are they doing? What are they doing about life? I was really struck by that. I was really struck by that. Somehow coming from outside, it sort of wakes something up. So I think it's really important to remember that when we talk about facing dukkha, we mean it as a universal, an attribute of the universe. We mean it to include those children being bombed in Gaza and the dreadful weight of history. We hardly can escape the weight of history. This huge, almost crushing weight. So over-personalising pain and dukkha, even though that's understandable, can't be right. The danger, it's very easy to sort of drift off into, depth psychology, soul therapy, all those kind of things. And eventually it becomes a dead end. I think it can be useful for some people some of the time, but eventually it becomes a dead end. The second way I think that we have for avoiding dukkha is to depersonalise it. That by some kind of jiggery pokery, we wish the problem away. Yeah? Or more accurately, that we try to think the problem away for pseudo-philosophical reasons. The current version of that is this idea that there's no self, no history, no one suffers, and so on. This seems to me very much a modern phenomenon. My own theory is that we're so saturated with words and thinking and ideas, like human beings have never been before in history, so saturated with words, thinking and ideas, that we easily mistake them for experience. Because most of our experience is words, thinking and ideas. We live increasingly through the web, so we can easily, instinctively, almost habitually mistake them for experiences. So we end up with some kind of mentalist insight, a mind insight, which I've even started to wonder as to be a little bit analogous to what's called a false self. It's a psychological term. When children are not loved, some children are not loved by their parents, in the desperation of childhood, they try and come up with a self that their parents will love. And before they know it, they've found a self their parents love, a talented self, a something self, and then they start to believe that that's who they are. It goes on for very, very early on, and they get very frustrated if people don't relate to that self-belief that they have. Do you see what I mean? I think there could be a similar thing with this sort of mentalist view of life. You could start to have a mentalist view of yourself, and then get very frustrated if people won't relate to you through that view. Yeah. But either way, the danger is to depersonalise it and to sort of think the problem away in a sort of pseudo-philosophical sense, even a Buddhist sense. But the third problem, we might avoid our dukkha is a rather clumsy formulation, but I've called it to movementise it. To movementise it. I couldn't think of a word. By this I mean to take the developmental model literally. I think this kind of way of avoiding dukkha affects dutiful people, like myself, for instance. You start to think that if I really do the right things, all the right things, I'll get better and better and better, and then eventually I'll make spiritual life work. I think I've done this, confuse the idea with spiritual life working with life working. But life doesn't work. The purpose of spiritual life is to confront us with the fact that life doesn't work. It's not to make spiritual life work, if you see what I mean. But I think if you take the developmental model literally, naively, unthinkingly, because we haven't thought enough about what Bandhi is trying to tell us, I think you can end up with that view, and I think I have done that at times. Either that, or we can give ourselves to the institutions of the movements unthinkingly, if loyally, and hide behind them, as if creating and spreading the movement is the solution to suffering. Yeah, that you just sort of get yourself behind the institutions of the movement, and you can think that just by doing that, by going to lots and lots of meetings, nothing wrong with meetings, they can be very, very good, there's too much disparagement of them, but as if that is the solution to suffering on its own level, which really strikes me as a kind of sociopolitical version of spiritual life, a little bit like a socialist might have. If we get back game together, if we create the right institutions, if we get everybody on board, we can change the world. And what happens with that is you end up with the resentment, disappointment and frustration that occurs when people don't get behind your vision, when they won't get on board your vision. So that's what I call to movementize it. I think you can hide in this movement. You can hide outside of it. You can hide in fact, you can hide anywhere. But primarily, we're hiding from dukkha. Primarily, we're hiding from dukkha. So what I've been trying to say is what we really need is an awareness of dukkha, a really experienced awareness of dukkha. Individually, this is so important because dukkha is not a thought. I think this is one of Subhuti's points, that dukkha is not a thought. It's not a theory. It's not a pre-conscious theory. It's a directly felt, embodied, existential dissatisfaction that ordinary life refuses to solve. That was my little definition of it. It's a directly felt, embodied, existential dissatisfaction that ordinary life refuses to solve. And even though we keep on trying to solve it with ordinary life, we're from cakes to sex to whatever, ordinary life refuses to solve the problem of life. Even a conventionally Buddhist life refuses to solve it. Globally, going back to David's story and his concern about the Buddha's smile, the dukkhas are really the place where Buddhism starts, because the problem of suffering is universal, enormous, and there's no word big enough to say it, is there? Enormous is too small a word, enormous and urgent. And offering personal insight seems to me quite disgraceful as a Buddhist response to that. If I'd said to David, well, tell you what, I've decided I have no history and no self, it would have been disgraceful as a response to his very genuine question about why the Buddha's smiling to himself. At the same time, clearly, we're not trying to liberate people into ordinary unhappiness. That Bant is quite right about that. We can't be just trying to liberate people into ordinary and unhappiness. I think that's Freud, isn't it? I can't remember. We're not trying to help people get into ordinary unhappiness. We have this transcendent goal. So to conclude, the way I think we know we need, what I've been talking about is we need to attend to dukkha. To the degree that we genuinely do that and we don't avoid it by over-personalising it, by depersonalising it in this mentalist way, or by just hiding within institutional forms and sort of hoping for the best, the way we know that we're really in touch with dukkha is if Shraddha arises. If Shraddha arises in us, and we'll know that primarily through our actions, we can trust that. We can just live more and more from that. We don't need to then worry so much about our own shortcomings or other people's shortcomings. After all, much of the Shraddha I experience is because of things that you do. Actually, interestingly, much of the suffering I experience is things that you do, and vice versa. We create each other's suffering and we create each other's Shraddha. It's a shared matter. It's never an individual matter. That's just a kind of way of talking. So we don't need to worry then too much about our collective shortcomings if we can live in more and more in accordance with faith in the three jewels. If we can just enter into the spirit of the Dharma by that. If we do that as an order, if we can be in contact with Shraddha, be in contact with Dukkha so that Shraddha arises, then we will be a source of hope for an increasingly agonized and divided world. Thank you.